My current interest is in prison health, but that shouldn't put you off, I hope, too much. Corey, likewise, has explained all the things I'm about to explain to you and the phenomena behind them. But my wider interest is in the health
coming.
of, here we are,
Oh,
thank
it's
you,
now.
marginalized groups. Thank you. My wider interest is in the health of marginalized groups, and migrants are certainly them. Also, as a public policy advisor and a director of public health, like Alan, I've come across a number of these issues to do with the populations we look after. Really, to underscore a number of contributions you've had already, Dr. Hatcher said, quoted bits out of ancient history. I'll quote Adam and Eve and Moses, and as the Council of Europe recent report on migration said, that these were people on the move. And people on the move are as old as history itself. So this migration is not a new phenomenon, and certainly it's been talked up in the US as a great merit of its history, as Corey has rightly said. I'm going to focus on post-World War II in terms of what Europe has done, but I want to pause there because I'm going to say it slightly critically, it's been a haphazard development. Why has it been a haphazard development? I think you've got to look at what went before to realize that a development in migration that was not haphazard was pretty bad news. I'll come back to that. And I'm also going to trace the phases of acclimatizing ourselves as a continent in Europe to the fact of migration in these last 60 years. But more recently, some very major structural changes have happened in Europe, and these have driven migration and driven that sharp upswing that Alan's graph clearly showed from the 60s, a gradual increase to the last 10, 15, 25 years, which has been a very marked increase in migration. And these are the historical events that are happening in Europe to drive that sort of trend. And I want to focus on the second last there, healthcare worker shortages. As Western Europe, Northwest Europe, has become more affluent and has spent a very large amount of money on its healthcare system, we have drawn in and actively and consciously drawn in healthcare workers from other parts of the continent and other continents too. Seen as a rather sudden development, but has had enormous consequences for the countries from which these people have come. And it was a major driver of migration in the last 15, 25 years, less so now, but think of what the consequences have been for the rest of the world. Not very clever in the case of the rich West. But rarely has migration been driven by health or public health considerations. And that is probably not a bad thing, but it certainly has made us hesitate in considering what the health implications of migration might be. One reason I would advance is what happened before the Second World War and during it. And that was the use of migration, the most major movement of people was, of course, around the time of the Nazis and the effect on the Jews and the traveling people, the Roma people, has really colored a lot of public health, quite apart from the history of associating health with migration ever since. And it's this hesitancy to get to grips with migration and health in Europe, which I think is a legacy of the Nazi times when public health, public hygiene was a big theme. Certainly, if you go to Central Europe, Germany, Austria, they don't want to talk about public health, and they talk about it with great circumspection, and it's precisely because of that. Just to define what I mean by Europe, we're all into terms, and I'm going to come on to a number of issues that Alan's raised already in terms of typology and so on. But that's what I mean by Europe in this talk. WHO Euro extends from over there and Reykjavik all the way to the east side of Asia. But I really want to talk about what we would call old Europe, Western and Central Europe. And just to point out that migration patterns have been many. there's been a migration from east to west of Europe, from the north of Africa, which is just popping off the picture there, into the south of Europe. And there's also been a very large migration by sea or by air from what we would regard in Britain as the old Commonwealth, but other colonies of former empires, Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, French, and so on. And old ties have created quite a significant movement of people since the Second World War. In our own case in Britain, from Southeast Asia, Pakistan, India, but also the Caribbean, major movements of people into Britain. Portugal's interesting because it has traced a lot of its movements from the old Portuguese colonies, but also more recently from the east of Europe, Turkey, Ukraine, and so on, with the opening of borders in the Eastern Europe to both migration, but also in the economic zone that we've now created in the European Union. We've got a lot of Bulgarians and Romanians moving, where there was a big wall against their movement before because they were behind the Iron Curtain. So there's Europe, and what I mean by Europe is roughly out there on the map. I want to... you've had a number of frameworks for thinking about migration. This is borrowed from Raj Bhopal's book, a fellow Edinburgh resident of mine. He's Professor of Public Health there, and he's quoting from Johnston. And these are the four phases he detects in terms of our thinking about migration, particularly since the Second World War. And these have been covered in previous presentations about unusual diseases, what's coming in through the ports, communicable diseases particularly. And then biological differences. We started talking about, for instance, thalassemia and the inherited diseases, the blood diseases. What's wrong with people who are coming from other countries? What's particularly distinctive about them? So one and two are how we tell these people apart. Number three, how we tell these people apart, but they've got the same diseases as us. Coming to terms with differences and similarities. And four, adapting our policy, our research and services to assimilate people rather than just call them apart. Now, I put the late 90s for that, but I think various countries around Europe and perhaps also parts of the US have taken this at different paces and have assimilated more slowly, and some have taken backward steps. Alan has already talked about migration typology, as I put it here. It's a rather grand title for types of ways of looking at it. There's the long and the short term. There's the temporary or the permanent. But I would particularly draw your attention in public health terms and the health of marginalised groups to the lower, the groups in the lower part of the slide, particularly undocumented migrants, irregular, you might call them, undocumented, asylum seekers, refugees, and externally placed persons. These are UN definitions from a document in 1998, and they really are the ones of particular concern in public health practice. And then again, as Alan said, there's the pull factors, the push factors, and coercion and criminal activity, which I've actually identified separately. The push factors concern me in public health practice more than the pull factors because they're more opportunistic and usually born of affluence and high skill rather than people who need to move to get away from something. And then there's these frameworks of conventions and so on, which we've heard about. I would like to boast that they're European, and that's why we are ahead of you in the United States, but they're not. These conventions are born of UN declarations, as has already been said, UN declarations and also the Charter of Rights, Cultural Rights and so on. I'll get the full name for you in a minute. But international covenant and cultural, economic and social rights, which underpins the framework of ways that we can protect our health and protect the health of migrants and advocate for them. This was produced in 1966 and ratified finally in 76, and unlike the earlier declarations, are legally binding in that they are cited in court and nation states are held to account. What about these frameworks and conventions, and particularly about the European Social Charter? Well, they're enshrining the rights of specific groups. It's not just this this phrase under Article 11, but also Article 12 in the UN Declaration, the highest possible standard of health attainable. In fact, as you go through the manual of this conference, that phrase comes up repeatedly. And migrants are no less entitled to achieve that high, possible standard than anybody else. But it's actually enshrining that in law and access to services and so on, which is a big challenge in this particular subject. But also, our frameworks focus on particular groups, families, children, and special assistance and so on. And I won't go through the text of these, but the articles go on and on, so to speak, but they are all focusing in on particular rights of particular groups. And again, I've subtexted that ECHR, European Convention on Human Rights, but it needn't necessarily be so. They are born of wider UN declarations. So what is the migrant health agenda? And I'm perhaps covering old ground, but I just want to dwell on TB, malaria, hepatitis B and HIV. A very useful document came out from the UK Health Protection Agency just to try and grind out what is known about this. And as other contributors have said, the data is not very good, mainly the data about where people come from and how recently. Quite strange, I've travelled a number of countries in the last few weeks, and the Spanish and the French like to know when you arrive and when you leave your countries, and I'm sure the US, when I leave the country, will want to know that I have gone. The UK doesn't seem to know whether I've left or not. So they know I've arrived, but they don't know if I've departed. Very strange that we have very poor data on emigration, that or remigration. We've got a lot of data on immigration. So we don't actually know who's in the country at any particular time. So it's the denominator issues rather than the numerator issues that are particularly interesting or particularly flawed, certainly in the case of UK data. They have described the burden of disease that foreign-born people present to us. And the first thing to say is that the prevalence of disease in immigrant communities may be higher than the background, that is the host community, but they're not that much higher. For instance, HIV in some populations may be 4%. Well, 4% is a lot lower than it was from the population from which they've come. And if you look at the scale of population movement, large as it may be, it is a minor bite on the large skin of the NHS, which is our public health system. It is not going to overwhelm us in terms of access and rights to access for care for these conditions. For TB and malaria, new cases, between 50 and 70% of new British cases are from foreign-born people. Again, quite low prevalence and incidence of these diseases, and we can cope. Is the message, and both the message that I would like to give, but also the message of the Health Protection Agency. Third, the spread of these diseases, TB and malaria, is very low between the immigrant population and the resident population. You really have to try quite hard to pass these diseases on. So it's not exactly a threat to the integrity and health of the country. One more myth to burst amongst the many who have come up this morning. As I've said, information is generally poor. That is a conclusion of that report. But also, and I've said in my second point here, the nature of migration has changed. And SARS, I think, has really underscored that. SARS is not a function of migration so much as a function of very rapid travel for various reasons, including business and travel, predominantly business and travel. Migration, in terms of being a threat to world health and communicable disease health, has been eclipsed by normal travel to and fro for reasons of choice rather than opportunity or necessity. So the game has changed in terms of migrant health. It is one thing to talk about communicable disease and migrants' health, but it's quite another thing to get it in perspective beside all the other things that are going on, much less of an influence than it may have been, say, 50 years ago. Much more of an issue now is to look at the non-communicable diseases and non-communicable phenomena that both Alan and Corey have underlined. Those of lifestyle and the particular cultural aspects of people's lives in migrant communities. Also, a very much greater focus on what I call the killing diseases, or the chronic diseases too, particularly focus on diabetes and cancer, hypertension, among prominently within cardiovascular disease. These are the issues that will exert a burden on care and also are worth measuring amongst migrant communities. And third, here, mental health, not just the mental health of and stress of moving around the world, but the mental health tendencies that new communities and migrants come to new countries with. It is right to understand and come to terms with these things. All is not lost, though. There's a great deal of activity, I think, in the last 10 years around this. We've already discussed the World Health Assembly's discussion of the phenomenon of migrant health. And Alan has laid out a number of the main points, and I will take it in a slightly different set of points in a minute. But there's all these other things going on in Europe. The EU and succession states, it's increasing interest. We take it in turns in Europe to take the presidency, and in fact the Portuguese presidency focused on the issue of migrants, and attached to that was migrant health. Council of Europe is an interesting body, mainly to do with conventions and rules and ethics and human rights, and is maybe a small and little understood organisation, but is a nugget of gold amidst a sort of grey morass of European institutions sometimes. Watch the Council of Europe for doing the right thing and supporting the sort of agenda we have. Then these reports on specific issues in disease and health, the health sector, and the particular commitment of UEFA in looking at migrant health. Dr. Davili, I don't know if he's here, but has really hit the front in Europe in terms of focusing our minds and the need to do things about that. Other reports, Médecins du Monde, and emerging foci of academic activity. So all is not lost, and certainly good things are happening in Europe, which we would like to talk up and bring to the table in terms of joint activity. And lastly, if people don't get the care to which they're entitled, there's the courts. And it's a pity that we see so much court action to force people to force countries to adopt policies rather than just to form policies in a proactive way. So what does the World Health Assembly resolution say? Well, it says these nine things. Six are there and three to come. They are about institutions, they're about processes, it's about integrating services for people who are migrant with other people, other groups. It's about specific focus on women and children and vulnerable groups of other sorts. But it's also about partnership, and the last three underscore that. It's about partnerships for action and contributing to the bigger picture. If we do it right for people who are migrants, we contribute to the bigger picture, such as Millennium Development Goals, MDGs. And last, there's another 10 actions for the WHO Director General, but this opportunity, in 2 years' time, she's required to report back to the World Health Assembly. Not much time to turn around a response to the various things that have been mandated for WHO. So there's an agenda here, it's moving fast, and we could be in there contributing. I won't dwell on this greatly, but I think it really underscores issues that other people have come up. The information needs to be better. It's not just about health need, but healthcare need, our response to what we know. And it's about services that are culturally and ethically correct, about protection and health-promoting services rather than just services to address specific diseases. And really these are the nub of what I think needs to happen and what might the international agenda be, which is about entitlement not just to services, but to preventive programs. And I put these differently because in European law, there's entitlement to services, but the European courts are a bit more choosy about preventive programs. They don't see them as an entitlement, necessarily. Service responses, not just entitlement, but access to services. And this broader public agenda that we've got to burst some myths around, as Corey has said. We've got to engage the public and the politicians to blow away what seems to be a great story without too many facts when people are trying to scare us witless about what might be going on for our immigrant communities. I have a prison interest, and here's some prison statistics. This is the proportion of people in various prison systems who are foreign-born. And you may not be able to see the subtext, but on the left is Switzerland, as has already been pointed out, very, very high immigrant population. And these are the top 13 or so large countries. I've taken out 8 smaller countries. You've heard about Liechtenstein and Luxembourg already. They're very, very high too. But these are big countries with very, very high immigrant populations. All of these, except the one on the right, the England and Wales, are around 20% of their populations or more. So our prisons are coping with a very high proportion of people who are foreign-born. And I think listening to Corey, there's lots of explanations why that might be, but not criminality necessarily. And here is that data presented beside the census data on the proportion of immigrants. And the point of showing this is that there is a concentration between 2 to 4 times of people from other countries in our prisons. So for every marginalised group, we have a concentration of them in our prisons. Why is that? Well, we've had that discussion. And the Californian picture, the US picture, is no different from what I imagine our picture is, except we don't have the studies that back that up. Near to last, what is migration all about? It's not bad news. It's like globalization. You could say it's a bad thing, but it's not. Migration happens for all sorts of very good reasons. But our job is to pick up the people who may suffer or have the potential to suffer and therefore to benefit from our attention and our commitment to them. Our public health approach has to address the needs of vulnerable group. Migration is a public health issue. It's an issue not only of that, but of human rights and an issue of human decency. We need to be there for women and children from other countries, from asylum seekers, for undocumented migrants, because they're at particular risk. And there are ways of doing this, and there are also prevention issues. We have to stop people doing the wrong thing, because there are many, many examples of migration and health coming up with the wrong answers and damage being done to fellow human beings. That really concludes what I've got to say.